as we traveled hunting for seals, came onto a land, fast ice, and were lucky to catch a seal, at which time the land, fast ice, began flowing away at a rapid pace. We were not worried because we had secured our seal, but we also saw other hunters who had to run for safety, so they began discarding their game they had caught. We began retrieving them so we would have more to eat. We were fortunate to retrieve those games. At that time, we were not able to hunt for whales because we were late in whale hunting, but at least we had secured game, thus enabling us to survive a little longer. I do not have much more to say at this point. I hope that I have helped out in what I had to say. That was Alfred Leavitt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please give Mr. Leavitt our thanks, too.
Justice Berger and colleagues, friends, I think you can understand from what he read to you about how the whaling captains view their whaling activities. It is not just for them. And if you can imagine what happened, what reaction came about in 1977 when they were asked to stop whaling, it was incomprehensible. And people were deeply hurt. And then we started, the people gathered together in 77 to deal with it in Barrow from the nine villages who are presently in the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. And that was the time when the Whaling Commission was formed to deal with the ban on bowhead hunting. I remember listening to the meeting. I was out working for a camp where we were teaching kids how to hunt, teaching them about the plants, teaching them about our way of life. And listening to it, people were very upset. Men and women were all crying. And it still affects me very deeply that we were hurt by something like that. And when we started fighting for it, after the Whaling Commission got together, one of the things that we had, some of the things that we ran across were people did not believe that we were still whaling traditionally the way we were and still carrying on the traditions that we did. And at one time I took a movie to Washington, D.C., and they thought we had actors actually out there with our parkas and the sailboats. People did not believe the Eskimos when they said there were more than 800 whales out there. We see them going by. We're the ones out there. People did not think that we were intelligent people, I guess. They thought they knew better. But these people were from Washington, D.C., from all parts of the world. And we were put in a very difficult position. And but I see the same sort of things with our other activities. It's still, lots of people still have a hard time understanding what subsistence mean to the people. I know with the caribou, you know, people did not believe what we were saying, that there were more caribou, things like that. These were the kinds of things we were facing in 77. And for many years, I've been involved since 1978, for many years people wouldn't listen to us. And in 1980, it had gotten so bad, we were facing the federal grand jury for taking a whale in Kaktovik. And we were taken to court because of our subsistence activity. People were, again, deeply hurt that we were being treated that way. In 1980, we got together with people, the scientists down in Seattle, tried to work with the scientists, even though we were at odds with our own government, and tried to work with the US government scientists to try and do something. And at that time, we ran into some of the people from Washington, DC, and made an agreement that if they could go back and take the grand jury away, that we would seriously sit down with them and try and come up with a solution. Because at that point, the Native people were so angered, they did not want to deal with the federal government anymore. They were shutting the government out because they weren't being heard. And then that's when discussions opened again with the government. They went back and started working on taking the grand jury out. When we heard that they were doing that, we went down to Washington, D.C. in March of 1981 and made an agreement, not specifically following any particular law with the federal government, but an agreement between the management plan that it was an agreement utilizing what was already up there in the North Slope and the Western Alaskan villages. They were utilizing the management plans that were already existing in the villages, and they were also utilizing the leadership that was already there in the villages, and made an agreement that this agreement was in effect, the US government was accepting our management plans, our leadership up there, and allowing us to regulate ourselves with the existing plans, management plans that we had in the villages. And left one thing between the federal government and it also goes into the IWC, also gives people a chance to put their input, and this one thing is the CODIS that we still have to live under. Everything else, the government agreed to utilize what was already there, and that's pretty much the way we operate today. And it's been very effective. There's been no problems. People were afraid that we wouldn't follow through with it. But in the most difficult circumstances, the villages have been able to manage themselves and stopped when they needed to, even though they were hurting themselves, basically, by following the CODA. Some villages don't have the cash economy that some of the other villages do, and we know they're going hungry, and it's impacting their lives still today. What he's talking about is, what Alfred was talking about is presently similar situations that people find themselves in when they're out whaling. They don't have heating, some of them don't. Some of them go hungry, they stay awake and try and catch a whale to feed their families and the community. And under their circumstances, the villages have been able to manage themselves, and lots of times people didn't think they would, and they have been able to do that. And presently, we're still dealing with the International Whaling Commission, trying to make them understand the degree of need that we have in the villages and how important it is to those villages culturally, spiritually, and also in our social, in our society. The whaling captains are leaders. And if you look at the leadership in the North Slope, the mayors and the people who are from the villages, the mayors and the North Slope Borough, people who are involved with that, people who are leaders, are whaling captains. Whaling has given that, given us that structure, and it's still presently very much something that we follow. A whaling captain is respected. He's a leader. He has to be able to be a leader in order to go out hunting. He's got to lead his crew, and he's got to lead the community in ceremonies. He's got to be able to do that. So presently, also, we're trying to work with the federal government. Finally, we're working together. And it's in sciences, in bowhead whale research, the Native community has taken the lead. We've lobbied the federal government to continue research. And this research is applied not just to the whaling CODIS, but the majority of it is. But some of it is applied to the oil industry activities. And we see the unfair treatment between the two. They go after the CODIS very hard, but when it come down to the industry, they don't use very much of it. They sort of let it slide by or put it aside. The information that is gathered, we work with the federal government in those, in sciences and also in studies, to record what is up in, what is there in the whaling villages in terms of social sciences, and also recording some of the history. I mean, we've done everything that we could to cooperate, and sometimes we don't get any cooperation. Even though we don't get any cooperation, we take the lead to do something about it. No one's going to do it for us. We've taken that attitude that we're going to do it for ourselves. But anyway, before I go too far, I wonder if there are any questions.
Marie, yesterday Harold Sparks was talking about the AVCP involvement with having to travel to meet with other users of the Pacific Flyway, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs participation in that was merely, well, was one of providing funds for the villagers to be able to travel to California to take care, to take part in those meetings. But then Harold went on to say, excuse me, that all the negotiations between the state of California and the AVCP people was carried out by the villagers, by the people themselves with the state, and there was no federal involvement in those negotiations. And if I understood him correctly, there wasn't really any state participation in that. And you've said that the International Whaling Commission people would not believe Eskimo people when they said how many whales are up there. And so now the North Slope is involved in using acoustical location devices to generate the type of activity or the type of information that will, I guess you might say, substantiate what Eskimo people already know. Well, the Bureau is participating in that to some degree financially. And I also understand that there are 17 other nations that take the bowhead whales. And my questions then are, one...
Excuse me.
My first question is, in the negotiations with those 17 nations, now is the negotiating done by the Eskimo Whaling Commission? Is it done by the federal government for the Eskimo Whaling Commission? Or who does that part of it?
Before the International Whaling Commission meetings, the AEWC meets with the federal government, and we negotiate what position should be carried out to the IWC. So the work is done before we go to the International Whaling Commission negotiating what position the United States government takes to the IWC. So we're very much involved with it. And the 17 nations you're talking about, they do some whaling. They don't take bowhead whales. Bowhead whales are considered an endangered species, and the Eskimos are the only ones who are allowed to take that. They hunt sperm whales and some other fin whales.
I also understand that about a year and a half ago, the International Whaling Commission in its newsletter made a statement, which I found surprising, that the depletion or decline in the population of the bowhead whales was due to commercial take and not to subsistence. I believe that's what the International Whaling Commission did make that statement, didn't they?
They did make that statement, but it was largely due to the efforts that we made to say what was historically true in their records.
Okay, my next question might be a little bit more difficult. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is involved in a program of statewide advocacy and protection of Alaska Native rights to subsistence, cultural lifestyles, traditions, and is in the process of developing policies on how to for decision-making to meet the federal trust responsibility for representing and supporting Alaska Native subsistence interests. And so since it's in that development stage, what would be the Eskimo Whaling Commission's recommendation as to what the Bureau's policy should be to carry out that trust responsibility?
One of the things that we do with the Whaling Commission is we allow all the whaling captains to participate in the decision making. Each of the villages have meetings and decide what their needs are, and then the commissioners get together and sit down together from each of the villages with a representative from a village, and agreed by consensus. Everyone agrees by consensus. If there's any disagreement, they sit down and resolve that issue and come up with an acceptable solution. And then from there we go to the federal government. I think that the most participation that you can get from the users allows people, you know, to come up with something that's acceptable. Otherwise, if it's unacceptable, there's a lot of hard feelings and your management is, you know, questionable sometimes. But if you have something that's acceptable, that works out pretty well. That's what we've learned with the processes that we've had to go through with the Whaling Commission.
I have a couple of questions, but any other questions around the table? Steve?
I wondered if Marie could comment on what her the present situation in the Commission's eyes with regard to the influence of the conservationist movements, both nationally and internationally, in the attempt to halt whaling, subsistence whaling. Is that still a concern? Is that presently an issue to the Commission?
Presently, the focus is on stopping all commercial whaling. They've separated commercial whaling and subsistence whaling. There is now a separate management scheme for subsistence whaling. So most of the effort the last couple years has been to stop all commercial whaling, and they're phasing that down. And supposedly it's supposed, you know, ending in 1986. But in between times, they deal with the bowhead whale issue, and it's coming up this year, the next following year, and I know they're going to be really focusing on that, and there's quite a few issues that we're going to have to face. But they're not looking at stopping subsistence whaling, but they're looking at everything else that we do short of stopping it.
Tom Lohner.
Marie, the costs of the AEWC must be very high with the travel and science and so on. How are these huge expenditures of energy and so on underwritten? Is there someone or an agency that is supporting financially and with other methods the efforts of the AEWC?
For the scientific research, we do lobby the U.S. Congress and the state legislature, and we have gotten appropriations from them. For the operating expenses of the Whaling Commission are from the North Slope Borough, all of travel, and we've worked it out so it's a lot more efficient than it used to be. So it doesn't take that much. And it's our experience has been that coordinating with the federal government, the state government, and the North Slope Borough, coordination has cut down a lot of unnecessary expenses.
Dave Porter, and then Rosita.
Recognizing that the Inuit of the western and eastern Arctic parts of Canada also subsist on the whaling economy, is there any present working relationship with those people? And if not, are there any discussions towards cementing some sort of structural relationship between your peoples?
Under the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, there is a Inuit Circumpolar Whaling Commission. We meet at least once a year and discuss the issues related to the Inuit people in Greenland, Canada, and Alaska.
Rosita Worrell.
Marie, maybe you could expand a little bit on, well, first of all, I thought it was really significant, you know, when I was doing some work with the whalers, how the whalers quickly adopted or learned about scientific principles, and I think you actually incorporated that into the management plan that you went to Department of Interior with. Maybe you could tell us just a little bit about that
how they
background.
Learned. Mm-hmm. Well, it was one of the strategies that they adopted was to learn everything that they can learn, and sciences was one of them. And they, in Barrow, I think Burton can explain to you a little bit more about how they do it in Barrow, but I know they sit down and interpret and go through the scientific jargon translated so it's understandable for them. Down like you soup you. And how you understand. Net recruitment, Nick Damat Koninga. Kavaravsi, net recruitment science. O Kavaravsi, bear whaling captains. Damn that Knicksim of Lu, Kara, the
same. Yeah, first of all, we got a keen eye. So we never close our eyes. We observe all the time. And every year we make a study of the great bowhead whale. It's been going on from time immemorial, like I said. Yeah. So it's just a handed down procedure, like, you know. And we are observing there is a large amount of whales than what is being put out today in the data. Thank you.
Does that help? Does that, in terms of the scientific thing, I think you can understand that they're very observant, and that's what science is based on.
Right. I guess the point that I observed with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission was that they quickly learned about net recruitment rate, MSY, and then based on that, they themselves developed their own management regime, and that was the one that they brought to Department of Interior.
The scientific data that's being worked on that I know of is it's a slow process. It's too slow for me, but got to have a little patience. Maybe in a couple of years we'll have a good data put together on bowhead whale.
Tony Vesca.
Thank you. As a distant observer of the whalers over the years, I do have a question, and the question is, yesterday we talked briefly about technological constraints by regulatory agencies, either the National Marine Fisheries Service, the Department of Fish and Game, the
Fish and Wildlife Service, find ways to redefine cultural and traditional ways of harvesting different species of animals. I know they do that for the whalers. Have you made suggestions either to the National Marine Fisheries Service or the International Whaling Commission about the use of perhaps more efficient whaling implements? Because I do know, for instance, that the Japanese and the Russians use large boats in the high seas to harvest whales.
That's one of the issues that we'll be discussing at the next International Whaling Commission meeting. We've been doing research on improving the existing bomb. One of the things that you have to realize that they take umiaks out on the ice, and you can't set a gun, you know, one of those handguns that they have, the Japanese house. And it's also, you'd have to teach everyone how to use it, and it's, it could be a very long time before they accepted. And what we've done is we've looked at what is there and try and improve on it. I think Burton would like to add more to that.
Well, in weapons, I have been with the old weapon for a long time, so it's hard to get away from it. My father, grandfather has been with it, so. In fact, I got one that's that was made in 1878, so one of the shoulder guns. And we go to a meeting in our locality about the weapon. We seem to have a resentment in going into different areas in the weapon-wise, because we're well-schooled in with what we got today. Thank you.
Woodrow Morrison and Rosita Worrell.
Okay, the question asked by Rosita about science part of it. One of the parts of ANILCA, the language says that in section 802.1 that the consistent with management of fish and wildlife in accordance with recognized scientific principles. And in southeastern Alaska, we were involved in a land exchange with the Bureau of Land Management, and we're doing an assessment of the biology of the area. And the biologist, a Western scientist, made the statement that based on timber types, aerial photographs, and that sort of thing, the area, the state of the art said that it should support a very large deer population. We told them there are no deer there, tried to explain, and finally had to take them out on a field investigation to show them there are no deer there and then explain to them why. So it seems like we're running at cross purposes to exactly what scientific recognized scientific principles are. And Mr. Rexford said that science there was based on having sharp eyes, in other words, an involvement with it. Do you find a conflict between what Western science says and, if you will, Indian science? And I use the term science meaning a search for truth. And again, I use the term Indian science to make the difference between Western science studying one species and Indian science studying the interrelationship between that species and other things. Do you find a conflict with that?
We do have conflict with that. We've always said that we've got all of this knowledge and it's unacceptable to the Western governments and to different organizations, you know, based on the Western society. So we've learned one thing, that we've taken the Western science, what is acceptable to them, that, but not because we're laying aside what we believe in. We're people continue to learn by observation, and they know they have that knowledge, and we're writing it down. We use that when we deal with the federal government, with the IWC, provide that information to them. But also, we've taken, even like Burton said, Western science is a very slow process, and we know what's there already, but with the Western science, it's takes a long time to prove something. But from observations out on the ice, people know what's there from pure observation. We do find there's a big gap between the two.
Rosita Worrell.
Observation. I've been fortunate enough to be able to be allowed to study whaling and go whaling for several years. And I recall one of the accusations that primarily made by conservationists was that Eskimos were hunting with modern weaponry. And I recall my first experience of being out in a whaling boat and watching these hunters with their modern whaling weaponry. And Burton might want to talk about the kind of things that they use, but they actually have these harpoons that I saw this guy standing up, and I saw this 40-foot whale coming up, and I saw this guy, you know, ready to shoot that harpoon into that whale. And I had a little problem trying to understand what conservationists were talking about when they were talking about modern weaponry. The thing that I did note that the Inupiat and the St. Lawrence Island Yupik are anxious to improve their equipment and weaponry when it is effective for whaling. I know that they have put in a lot of money to try to improve the weaponry, the bombs that they do have. According to the statistics, I think only about 1/3 of their bombs actually work when it's actually shot. But I do also know that National Marine Fisheries previously had not been supportive of them improving that kind of weaponry. The other thing is that they will also reject modern technology when it's not effective, and precisely I'm talking about the aluminum boats. They reject the use of aluminum boats during the fall time, even though it probably might save them little time and money, because the aluminum boats are not effective in whaling, and that the skin boats still continue to be the best in, you know, I guess for the noise.
I would like to comment on that. The whaling captains in Barrow, they use the skin boat to chase after the whales, but they've also learned that the aluminum boat is very noisy, so they don't use it when they're chasing them. But once they've struck a whale, they take some aluminum boats because it can take waves better than has a little bit more
stability
than the umiak does. So they use the aluminum boat after they've struck the whale. They learn to use technology to their best, like you said.
Dick Nelson.
I might just add something to that. From what little experience I've had with whaling at Wainwright and Point Hope over the years, and maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong about this. It seems that there outsiders who have no experience with subsistence generally often are resistant to the idea that modern technology is fair. and that modern technology counts. And a classic example of that, I think, is the technology that's used for whaling on the North Slope. And it's interesting to note that, if I understand correctly, that since the aluminum boat has been brought into use and the outboard engine for chasing whales that have been struck or whatever out on the ice, the number of whales struck and lost has declined, so that the loss of wounded animals has been reduced a tremendous amount, if I understand correctly, by using aluminum boats. And I think it's very important for people such as those from the conservation community, of which I proudly consider myself a member, to understand that oftentimes using modern technology serves the purposes both of subsistence users and of conservationists the best. That's sort of a comment and a question, just wondering if that is true according to the way you see it.
Your observation about that is basically true. They use whatever they can to improve the catch level, and we've been working on that for several years, and we're continuing to work on that. I think it's there's something here that should be said, and that is we do regulate some weapons, what is used and the method of striking a whale, but we leave it open-ended to see what would work out the best. And if it does, then, you know, people don't have problems with it. It's been, like you said, some conservationists with sometimes would prefer to see the Eskimos use the most traditional things, and they think that we're going away from tradition. But that's, in my mind, that's not something that is true, because the act itself has remained the same.
I read, and you alluded to the previous connection, at least, between the effort to ban commercial whaling and the bans that have occurred and the quotas for subsistence whaling. That's a connection that's always mystified me. But now that it, and so maybe it could you could explain it a bit more, and especially I'd like to know if there is still a connection between negotiations or policies for subsistence, for commercial whaling, that somehow affects the negotiations for subsistence whaling.
What is happening today with commercial whaling being attacked, the commercial whaling countries are looking for ways to protect themselves, and they're looking at how they might get included in with subsistence whaling, so it's still pretty much connected with the politics that go on down there.
Well, you've avoided the problem Don Mitchell posed, that is restricting other users. You say that there is no commercial taking of bowhead now, so are you the only Aboriginal people taking bowhead in the world now?
Yes, we are. It is, like I said, an endangered species, and no one else is allowed to hunt the bowhead whale. The allocations is given to the United States government and in turn to the Alaska Natives.
Yeah. I have
I would like to, I've been talking about endangered species. I would like to say, I use that term because it is something that the federal government, they classified as such, but in the minds of the Inupiat people, they've seen more whales than what has been counted. Like Burton was saying, they don't believe it is endangered. I wanted to say that before I got too far away from it.
Hugh Monahan, see if somebody will hand you a microphone.
I'm question for Marie and then a comment. Marie, looking at the structure of your Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and the IWC, do I take it your Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is purely made up of Eskimo people, and that from what you're saying, you then negotiate your position with the federal government, which then represents that position to the IWC, or do you sit with your federal government in negotiations on the IWC?
We go there after the position has been, well, we negotiate the position in the United States before the IWC, and we both go there and work together on it. But we sit wherever we can. If we have an opportunity to voice our own opinion, we'd like to say it out of our own mouths and not leave it to the government to say it for us.
That, I think, is similar to what is going to happen in Canada on a number of international agreements. In the process of negotiating land claims, our...
There's a microphone there that might...
Is that alive and well? I take it it is. The position of the Native people in the NWT has been that, to the greatest degree possible, they would like to represent their own interests on international negotiations, and the position of government has generally been that it's usually a government responsibility to coordinate national input in international negotiations, but they have indicated, and we've been an advocate of it, that the Native people themselves should be directly involved in the negotiations with the federal government wherever possible. So there seems to be some consistency there. I have a comment, and it's sort of a rambling comment rather than a focused one, and it's this business of pulling together traditional knowledge and science as we understand it. Peter Usher may also want to comment on that, given his experience in the NWT and other parts of Northern Canada. But we ended up in a situation in the Northwest Territories, and it was really focused on caribou, where up until that point, researchers, some of them that had worked very, very closely with people in the communities, had developed a fair bit of credibility, and as a result, their recommendations carried a fair degree of weight and credibility in the communities as well as with government. In other cases, we've had researchers who are somewhat more taken with science and see science as a solution to all problems. Their credibility has not often been high in the communities, and as a result, in many cases, we've run into some very serious management problems. When we develop a technocratic solution and go to implement it, there is little local acceptability and therefore little relevance. We've done a few things to try and get around that, and we're still learning. We don't know yet how successful they will be. One of the first was to set up a renewable resource training program at a technical level in the Northwest Territories with a particular focus on the North. And I think in Canada is probably the only one that has any training in marine mammals, to try and bring people from the communities into our organization to learn science, but bring with them also their perspective. And we hope in time that that'll help. Another technique that we've tried, and again it was precipitated by the Beverly Kaminary Act caribou management problem, we formed a joint board of native users in the communities as well as the government agencies to try and bring together the two values and the two systems and way of thinking to develop a joint management program. The management program has not only been purely running numbers together to figure out what an allowable harvest is, but as you've seen from some of the handouts here, it's broader, and that is education, both in the communities and of the administration by the communities, where we try and come to a common understanding of what the values are that should be used in setting up a management program. I don't know what relevance that is to your problem here, but it may have some. As I say, we're still on the very sharp edge of the learning curve on this in the Northwest Territories. That particular board has not yet completely proven itself, but it has definitely worked on an educational front both ways. It's been beneficial there. It's now developed a management program which is at a draft stage and nearly ready to go into the communities. And I suppose, most importantly, getting back to the science and joining together of public information, all research that is done on those two caribou herds is done by the government agencies responsible, but with the people in the communities. If we send a 185 up to count caribou or photograph caribou, we've got members of local hunters and trappers associations in the plain observing the techniques and commenting on them. So there's a strong attempt to try and bring these two forms of knowledge together. And as I say, we're still on the front end of the learning curve, but there seems to be some success in it.
Thank you. Any comment on that?
I'd like to comment on that. With the sciences, when we realized what some of the scientists were saying in the beginning when we started dealing with the scientists, we were basically battling each other. And then once we came to an agreement, we started working on a coordination process between the AEWC and the North Slope Borough and the federal government and the state government to coordinate what projects were being done and to get away from duplicating different scientific research. So we have been involved with that process, and before they go up to the villages, they ask for the permission of the whaling captains to go out there because they can be disruptive to some activities out there. So they do go to the whaling villages and ask for them to, ask them to support them, and they do, realizing what it is for.
That's interesting. There seems to be a fair parallel here, probably not a planned one, but the end result is the same. We have a scientific licensing system that any research conducted in the field is done through a scientific permit. Before that permit is issued, it is obligatory that there's consultation with the local Hunters and Trappers Association, and in some cases we require their involvement. Thanks.
I have a couple of questions that I might, if I may, I'd like to put before noon, and then in the afternoon we can start off with the International Porcupine Caribou Commission and